Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the question-and-answer session, please press star one on your touch-tone phone. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I now turn today's meeting over to Tish Hall, and you may now begin.
Thank you. I would like to welcome you all today to the webinar on behalf of the Office of Adolescent Health and the Administration for Children and Families, Family and Youth Services Bureau. We're really excited about sharing information with you today. Today's webinar on building and sustaining stakeholder support will be led by the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy, and our guest speaker or lead speaker will be Jennifer Drake Fantroy. I'd like to turn it over to Jennifer now.
Thank you, Tish, and hello, everyone. Good afternoon, or I guess good morning, depending on where you're calling in from. I really appreciate this opportunity to be here with you all and to be talking about such an important topic. Just a little bit about our objectives for today. We hope to just do some, we know you hear about this topic often and how important it is. I think what we hope for today is that you sort of leave with very concrete ideas about strategies for raising awareness about your program in a way that gets people in your community excited about it. I hope to do a little bit of work to explain how to differentiate among these supporters and really help you think about how you can better target your outreach efforts depending on what people's levels of interest are. And also to identify meaningful ways to engage them depending on how closely they'd like to work together with you. And a little later in the call, I'll also be joined by two of my colleagues, Nicole Ingrazano and Sally Swanson, who work at the community level. And I'll introduce them both later before they talk about their work, but they've done a really fabulous job in their communities of sort of applying some of the broader principles that I'll be talking about. So I think you'll enjoy the opportunity to hear them talk about how to practically apply some of this. So I know that you're running programs that have a lot of demands, and you might even be asking yourself, sort of out of all the things that my project officer and maybe my boss back home wants me to do, why should I be thinking about spending time on this issue? I think probably the best answer that I can give you about that is that your future success could really depend on it. Having a broad base of support and having champions in your community are two things that are recognized by experts as characteristics of sustainable initiatives. Also, some of the activities you take on to build these relationships within your communities may help you with the more immediate tasks that you're facing and worried about on a daily basis. For example, reaching out to school administrators or community organizations who have an interest in these issues could potentially help your recruitment efforts or implementation efforts. So these two things are among a broader list of issues that we think community-based initiatives and programs should be thinking about when they're thinking about how to make their programs last into the future. We often talk about how important stakeholder education is and sort of what approaches might be helpful when you're thinking about what specific audiences you want to reach out to, but I thought a good place to start today might be to simply answer the question, how do you do stakeholder education? So sort of literally, how do you even get started? And so we'll talk through these five tips that are on this particular slide, sort of the five key steps that we outline here in this webinar and also in a tip sheet that I think either has just gone out to you or will be going out to you shortly. Identifying the key people with substantial influence in reaching your community, so sort of figuring out who those gatekeepers are, connecting your work to what they do every day, even if it's not explicitly teen pregnancy prevention. Next, we think it's important to find ways to get the community meaningfully involved and really giving them opportunities to weigh in ways that are mutually beneficial and sort of avoiding tokenism that I think sometimes, even though we're well-meaning, can be a result of sort of community outreach efforts how do you keep them involved once they get involved? And then, of course, thanking them profusely and letting them know how much you value their partnership, which is a really important part, I think, of doing this work, particularly if you're not based in the community, or maybe you're a statewide organization that's going into a community where you don't live. So on the first point, sort of identifying key people with substantial influence, I think, you know, this question is just who are the stakeholders? And I don't think I can give you a definite answer, because I think that the answer to that question will vary depending on what community you're working in. But I wanted to give you a couple questions to think about as you're trying to figure this out. Sort of who are the gatekeepers, for lack of a better way to say it? Who do you need in your corner to reach the most people? And you might need to ask a few questions to figure this out. Sort of who's making a difference on the issue we work on teen pregnancy prevention? That might be influential medical groups or clinics or reproductive health organizations. A slightly different question you might want to ask is, who's making a difference for youth overall? That might be youth-serving organizations with a slightly different focus, other nonprofits, maybe child welfare agencies within your community, schools, job training programs. Who's the broader community listening to about this issue and about social issues in general? Sort of who do they trust? And I think that is an important question that will get you a lot of different answers depending on where you're working. I think another important item to remember when you're trying to identify these key people is that you can't reach everyone, and it might be strategic to make decisions about where you're spending your time and how much of your time that you're spending. Chances are you'll think of dozens of individuals who sort of fit this bill as being, you know, a VIP or having some influence in your community. So you might consider even doing a mapping exercise or some type of ranking process that will help you prioritize how who you target within the community, how much time you spend with them. For example, you know, gatekeepers and stakeholders will vary not only in terms of how interested they are in this issue, but also in even how much they agree with you in your approach to reducing teen pregnancy. So I think our advice to people when we hear that is just to think carefully about how much you even want to engage sort of hardcore opponents of your issue. And even though, you know, there's broad consensus that teen pregnancy prevention is an important issue to be working on, there are some people who may feel very strongly that you should be doing it differently. So think about how much you want to engage people like that, because, frankly, you might not need them to agree 100% in order to move forward, but it might be worth some effort to sort of neutralize them or ensure that they're not saying bad things about your organization or your efforts, and having them say nothing at all may be the most helpful option. So I'm sure, you know, not everyone is experiencing that, and we know, I've heard from lots of grantees who are having much success in being accepted with open arms, but that's just an example of why a mapping exercise might be somewhat helpful. And, of course, when you're identifying these gatekeepers, consider people within our field, people who get up every day to work on teen pregnancy prevention, people who are sort of similarly situated to you, sort of in a nonprofit or in a school or in an organization that looks like yours, and also consider people who are outside of your sector or outside of your field who may have some connection to this issue. This is just some more specific examples of who these groups might be. This is a really diverse list, to be sure, but I think it's sort of helpful to think of your stakeholders as being from a range of individuals within your community who work on different things. You know, towards the top of the list are people who are likely to get your issue and understand teen pregnancy. Others on the list toward the bottom may need some cajoling or convincing that teen pregnancy is even an issue that they should care about. So again, you know, just thinking about people who work on teen pregnancy, people who care about young people but maybe don't work specifically on teen pregnancy, who the leaders are, sort of the, you know, are there religious leaders or pundits or just sort of community activists that really have their ear to the ground and who people listen to, decision makers and policy makers. Though it's obviously important to not lobby elected or appointed officials with your federal funds, I think there are a range of activities you can do to educate them about the work that you're doing. Also, local media outlets, even individual journalists. You know, we hear lots of stories in communities where there's someone who's working at a TV station who maybe experienced teen pregnancy in their lives firsthand or in the lives of people around them and just have a special interest in this issue, or just maybe something that they're very interested in for, you know, other reasons. Also, think about business leaders and people with a direct influence on the local economy, because obviously there's a connection between that and teen pregnancy. I think even though this is a diverse list, I think one thing that people will have in common is that your project won't necessarily be their top priority or the thing that they, you know, they have sort of other jobs. So you'll be competing for their attention to a certain degree. So it's important to think about that in the context of your work and sort of consider their level of involvement with that in mind. And we've mentioned this before, provide them with information that really helps to connect teen pregnancy to whatever that thing is that does get them out of bed every morning. I think be prepared to make a strong case. The two things I would say here is just don't expect that they already know why they should care about teen pregnancy, and don't be surprised if their reasons for caring turn out to be much different than the reasons that you care, given your work. And just two other points that I want to mention that our community-level speakers, I think, will drive home later on in the call is, you know, data and personal stories are complementary, not competing strategies. You know, some people really, the numbers really resonate with them, and showing them sort of the evidence and the science behind what you're doing and sort of the very logical reasons that you've chosen to be involved in their communities will be really important to them. And other people want to hear sort of the stories that about real-life people that sort of pull at your heartstrings and sort of make you want to become involved. And there's a lot of sort of literature out there, and some of it is very specific to the reproductive health field and sort of working on health issues about how to do that in a way without being sort of exploitative and really taking advantage of young people who are willing to tell their stories. So there's a right way to do personal stories as well, just the same way that there's a right way to do data collection. And also, just don't forget that media is a really important tool. I think in a lot of communities, we sometimes hear people lament how the media negatively impacts young people and their views about sex and relationships. But I think what we hope to drive home today is that the media can also be an important tool for good, and it's a partnership that you should welcome rather than fear.
You've got mail.
Just to say a few words about how to create these opportunities for people to become involved in your work. I think just as a general matter, this seems like common sense it is, I think, to a certain extent, but it can't hurt to remind people that, you know, if you say you want to engage the community, you have to really mean that. Building support and even going a step beyond that to create champions means more in some cases than just inviting people to events, and it takes some level of engagement that's sort of greater than that. And by this point in the, you know, just pretending that we're going through a process at the community level of identifying people and sort of mapping where they are, by this point you have an idea of who your supporters are, how involved they want to be, and in what ways they want to be involved. And you'll find that some are perfectly fine with doing things like attending events for the community at large. But I think there will be other cases in which people may want to be slightly more involved and have some input on the process. I think the important thing for you all to remember is that you get to decide whether or not this is an appropriate role for your supporters and stakeholders. But I think, you know, it's, again, worth reminding you that if you solicit feedback from people, there's an expectation that you then take that feedback and decide what and apply what people are telling you and really incorporating their opinions. So you might consider whether or not you simply would like to have your supporters play a role in which they're sort of endorsing your plans once you formulated them internally. I think as long as you're very upfront about your expectations for whatever groups you establish, then you can be successful in doing that as well. I mentioned the idea of champions a couple times today, and I think you'll see that in the tip sheet as well. But basically, these are your top-tier, vocal, and very visible supporters. So this is a group that might require a bit more attention and have greater expectations for involvement. And they may even be people who hold very prominent positions in the community. So for these people who sort of you have some indication that they want to do more than others, it's helpful to consider whether or not it might be appropriate to choose special leadership positions that are appropriate for them. For example, some communities have found it helpful to form action teams, community action teams, or task forces to support their projects, or and even sort of offering leadership positions within those task forces to those champions who really want to have a say. But again, you get to decide sort of how much of that feedback that you invite, but just remembering that if you are inviting that feedback, there's some expectation that you be listening to them. And obviously, continuing to nurture the relationships is really important. Just keep reaching out, keep inviting feedback, keep seeking it. And if establishing your initiative or program within the community is a goal of yours, sort of that to make it a permanent presence, having these relationships with individuals and organizations who can help you do that is really key. For example, you know, if you're partnering with a group such as a child welfare agency or a school, that can make your curriculum a routine part of what's provided to the youth that they serve in perpetuity, that's obviously pretty beneficial. Or are there local donors or foundations that you can engage that are willing to contribute financially in the event that federal funds aren't available in a few years? And just a reminder that the media can be key partners. They may be able to help you get the word out about things or just keep teen pregnancy in the news in general. But I think the important thing to remember about the media, like any other relationship you have, is that they need to hear from you often and be reminded that your work continues and that it's really important to the community. And this is just a reminder of the point I mentioned earlier about partnership really being a two-way street, and that this is it's really important that you demonstrate your investment in the community, and that you know that there are other ways to do that than just by, you know, providing the really important service that you all provide, but that you can show that by learning about what they care about and supporting those events where you can and being involved where you can and sort of connecting those issues to what you're working on. And just the last point, you know, please and thank you. Perhaps it's because I talk to my very southern mother every day, but letting people know you don't take their involvement for granted, that it's not expected, that it's sort of something extra that they're doing, and that you appreciate that they're working with you goes a very long way. And just a final thought before I turn it over to my colleagues. Experts tell us that it really helps to have a sustainability plan. So just like you wouldn't proceed with your program without an implementation plan or a financial plan, you know, some plan to account for the money, be very intentional about how you'll make sure that your work continues. And experts say that that is a very important point. With that, I want to turn it over to Nicole Ingrazzano, who is the Vice President of Community Impact at the United Way of Greater Milwaukee, and they are working on a multi-year project to reduce teen pregnancy in the Milwaukee area through a multi-pronged approach that she's going to talk about a bit today.
Can you hear me?
I can.
Oh, good. I thought I had to do something. I'm very confused. It's a little high-tech for us in Milwaukee.
Nope, we hear you loud and clear, and I can advance your slides.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Well, thank you very much for affording me this time to talk with you today. That was a wonderful introduction and actually covered a lot of the things that I wanted to mention. But I'm going to talk a little bit about what has been our key to building and sustaining a pretty broad and interesting and diverse coalition around this issue. So those of you that don't live in Wisconsin may have heard a thing or two on the news recently about it being somewhat contentious politically around here, and that is indeed the case. But one of the things I would say, and I wanted to go back a little bit to the slide that referenced really gravitating towards natural allies or maybe involving only like-minded people, or at least to your point, which is, you know, weigh how much time you want to spend on inviting unlikely comrades. What has been critical to our success is that we have embraced a wide spectrum of across-the-aisle participants. I don't know that we could have moved the initiative forward if we had only assembled groups that were already like-minded. So I want to talk a little bit about that. What I think is that you have to reach and invite broadly. You have to say that you're going to have, I'll give you an example in our case. We have Planned Parenthood at the table, and we have a conservative coalition of faith leaders at the table. They don't agree on much, but what they do agree on is our end goal, which is to reduce births to teens by 46% in 2015. The pathways and the mechanisms we use to get there, or that they use to get there, are quite different from each other. But at the end of the day, we've been able to say, look, we're not going to talk about specifically in this larger group about those differences. Instead, we're going to talk about the goal, and we're going to focus on the goal. We have tried very, very hard to make this initiative relevant to everyone in this community. We started off, before we had much to talk about at all, with a really aggressive ad campaign. I can't emphasize enough the importance of having good media partners, because in order to change behaviors, in order to change belief systems, in order to change what in some communities has become a community norm, you have to first raise awareness that this is a problem. And in Milwaukee, we had become quite complacent to the idea of teen pregnancy. People didn't seem to be flinching when they saw 12-year-old girls pushing baby carriages, and they didn't seem to be concerned when they saw our high school graduation rate going down and down and down. And so we came out pretty aggressively. You'll see on this slide one of our early ad campaigns, which goes directly to the general audience and this atmosphere of complacency we felt we were living in. It shouldn't be any less disturbing when it's a girl. Now, I want to stress, too, the public awareness campaign that we do, not everyone loves our tactics. They're pretty bold. They're pretty aggressive. But I want to say a couple of things about that. One is that you can't have a public awareness campaign that lives in a vacuum and that isn't attached to services and education, and ours very much is. Two, every element of this campaign is vetted by its target audience. So when that target audience is the general community, we have a group of people from the general community that talk about it. When the target audience is youth or young people, children, we have members of that community come and talk about it and tell us what works. I am not the target audience, sadly, anymore, of these ads. So my reaction is much less important than the reaction of those that we are aiming them at. I'd like to talk a little bit about the different constituencies on the next slide, the different groups that we work with, and how we've sort of gone about engaging them and making sure that these different strategies are involved. People ask me all the time, how do I know which strategies of ours are working? And I really don't. I can't separate them out individually and say this is what's working and this is what isn't. What I can tell you from Milwaukee is that we have a bold and aggressive goal that is coupled with bold and aggressive collaborative efforts. And some of them that I want to talk to you about are listed here. But first, before I talk about these, I wanted to talk to you about one of the really important pieces of our collaborative, and I neglected to put it on our slide, is the engagement of the business community. Because you can have wonderful ideas and all the best intentions. You really need, we all know this, you need public support, you need stakeholders who have leverage and influence, and you need corporate dollars. So we made a very purposeful and aggressive outreach strategy early on to the business community. And this goes back to a little bit what you heard on the in the earlier part of this presentation, which is that we needed to make it relevant to the business community. My philosophy and perspective is that we should all care about this issue because it's a matter of social justice. But I've come to learn, and many of you will not be surprised by this, that that is not everyone's motivation for caring about and then addressing health disparities. What we learned by working closely with our business partners is that what really resonated to them was the finances of it all, was the tax burden incurred by having children born to teens, the fact that young people who don't graduate from high school can't be your future workforce as easily, the fact that if you're trying to attract new businesses to a community, say you're a chamber of commerce, which in our community trends to the right, how are you going to convince new corporations to come to this community if the atmosphere is one of poverty, teen pregnancy, and high school dropout rates? So we went in very, very early and very aggressively to have a specific ad and education campaign that was aimed just at business leaders to talk about the financial costs of teen pregnancy on a community as a whole. Again, my perspective and the perspective of my team is much more aligned with a social justice and a concern about education and health outcomes. And while I think that most people do care about that broadly, in order to make a case to our business community that this was something they really needed to invest in, both from an attention standpoint and financially, was that how this issue impacts their business and impacts their community. And so that was one of the strategies that we really focused on and continue to focus on. You have to broaden the conversation if you're going to address this issue. Teen pregnancy is not as simple as just saying, well, we're going to do sex education, or we're going to just talk about teens shouldn't have sex and that's the end of the story. You have to be willing to, one, meet people where they are, and two, engage them in such a way where that learning and growth will eventually happen. I can tell you that we have some members of our oversight committee, we're now in our fifth year, who have really come 180 degrees from where they started in terms of their understanding of this issue and their changing sort of why they're committed to addressing it. I say the same things about the other groups that you see listed on this slide. We have committees and coalitions and collaboratives attached to a number of different audiences and populations. We think that historically, sex education as a strategy, though very important, has ignored the broader familial context that happens or that exists, where children are getting instruction at school, perhaps, but then they're going home to receive conflicting or mixed messages from parents, and they don't really happen together. So we have built a very strong coalition of parents who we work with very closely to inform the tactics that we use. The second piece on here, which is the collaborative fund, goes to another constituency or sort of mini coalition, which is that of funders. I represent United Way of Greater Milwaukee. We're the largest health and human services funder in our community, but we can't fund this and do this alone. So we have done some very purposeful outreach to other funders, including community and private foundations, and together 10 of us have pooled dollars to fund as one unit, the Teen Pregnancy Prevention Collaborative Fund. This allows funders to communicate with each other more effectively, to not fund in a vacuum, to make sure that we're using similar metrics and that we're paying attention to each other's work so that we really can put our full weight behind programs that are actually working. The FAITH Initiative is another example of a very important stakeholder constituency. We have a large faith community committee, which is made up predominantly at this point by African-American Baptist churches. That's not on purpose. That just seems to be who has been gravitating toward these efforts so far. But we're doing a lot of specific outreach in the Catholic community, particularly on our south side with our Latino families, where we know there's some additional barriers to even talking about sex and contraception, much less actually using it. So I would say, and please cut me off because I'm not sure what our time frame is. If I'm going on too long, I want to make sure that everybody else has enough time to speak and ask questions. But to go back, it's sort of that everybody at the table does not have to agree on the approach, but they do have to agree on the outcome. And how we get to that outcome is going to take a lot of different paths. Now, that being said, within United Way, for example, we only support teen pregnancy prevention programs that are evidence-based and comprehensive. So even if someone that's a stakeholder is very strongly aligned with abstinence messaging, we don't change how we fund as a result of that. We listen, we share what we consider to be best practices in research, we encourage them to explore opportunities to, again, maybe broaden how they address it. But at the end of the day, if they go back to their nonprofit or their church and they implement a program we haven't sanctioned, that's okay. It's not ideal, but I think it's a gateway to getting them to, in turn, embrace a more aggressive curriculum. I'll give you one example. We work very closely with the Black Church Initiative of the Religious Leaders for Reproductive Choice out of Washington, D.C., and one of the things that they have there is a curriculum called Keeping It Real, which is a faith-based, Bible-centered teen pregnancy prevention curriculum. Again, not evidence-based, not solely abstinence-focused, but certainly in that direction. And so we've had a number of churches who have embraced this curriculum, and we've supported their capacity to implement it. What's happened, though, after 2 or 3 years of implementing this is that they have increased their trust of us. They have increased their knowledge of what strategies are actually working, and now several of the churches have actually agreed to implement Making Proud Choices, which, for those of you that work in this space know, is a comprehensive, evidence-based STI and pregnancy prevention program. So that's the transition that we've been looking for. We couldn't go into a church and tell a minister he should start giving out condoms from the pulpit, right? There's a level of comfort and trust and cultural competence that needs to exist before we move people along this continuum. But what we did do was listen, acknowledge differences, embrace the capacity that they did have to recruit and retain youth, and then move along the spectrum with them. And that's why I think we've been successful. Oh, sorry, next slide. So in our case, in our community, our community-wide efforts, and I really want to stress that, United Way is the lead agency on this initiative, but it does take a village. Births among 15 to 17-year-old girls in Milwaukee have dropped to their lowest levels in 28 years. In 2011, we had our largest single-year drop to date. And although we were thrilled this year that the national rates were also going down as well across communities, we know that there's still a great deal of work to be done. And I would say that, sort of in closing, that one of the most important and critical things for stakeholder retention is that you continue, you don't become complacent. You continue to drive towards the goal. We've had circumstances where people have suggested that they're not sure why we're still working on this because we seem to have already taken care of the problem. They think that once we hit 2015 and achieve our 46% goal, that somehow means that we need to put our resources at somewhere else. And we know that that's not the case. So I think what our coalition and our stakeholders have learned and what we've earned over the last 5 years is that we are not interested in creating reports that sit on shelves, and we're not interested in meeting just to meet, that what we're interested in, what every single person that's at that table, and it's a group of about 60, including the mayor, the county executive, the publisher of the local paper. We have judicial members of the judiciary. We have law enforcement, faith leaders, community-based leaders, concerned parents. Any sort of constituency you could think of is really represented at this table, and they stay there, and they've been there from the beginning. One, because we're having success, and I think we know that people like to be part of a winning team, so to speak. But the reason we're having success is that this broad-based, thoroughly engaged coalition has invested in this process. And I'd be happy to take questions, or I can stay on the line and ask, whatever you want to do in terms of your process.
Sure. Tish, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think we'll be able to take some questions at the very end of the call, right? Well, let's move on to thank you, Nicole. This is really great information. I've told you this before. I never get tired of hearing about all the stuff that you all are doing in Milwaukee, and I think the icing on the cake is the fact that, you know, your team birth rate for the city is moving in the right direction, so kudos.
Thank you.
Next, we'll have Sally Swanson speak. Sally is the Director of Prevention Programs at the Adolescent Pregnancy Prevention Campaign of North Carolina. And I think in particular what's among all of the great things that the campaign in North Carolina is doing is that they identified over the last couple of years or so one area where having some data really helped them to move their work forward, and that was doing some polling with some parents. So Sally's going to talk a little bit about that.
Thanks, Jennifer. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay. Well, first of all, I'd like to say that I think Jennifer and Nicole both did such a good job of putting down the framework or the rationale for why engaging stakeholders at all levels is so important. I mean, I really think it is such an essential thing to do to make any meaningful change, and so it's a good thing to concentrate on. In our process, where it is right now, we're part of the community-wide initiative and working really intensely with one of our counties in North Carolina to get pregnancy rates down. And part of that process, the first year, was really doing an assessment about what's happening currently, what's going on, who do we need to talk to, all of the things that Jennifer and Nicole just talked about in terms of gathering people. And we do have three leadership groups as a part of the project. We thought initially, well, let me just say, what I think lots of counties might identify this way, so I know it's been said before, but, you know, in terms of how our county identifies, they will say they're very conservative, and you don't quite know my county, and this is a tough topic for our county and our population, et cetera. So there was this feeling going in, even though we had so many partners, that there were areas where the self-perception of the county was that they were much more conservative and may not be supportive across the board of evidence-based programs and best practices in clinical services, which are two other main components of the project. And so we were looking at ways, as we gathered all our other data, to try to reframe or reassess that general perception that the county had and some of the main gatekeepers had, and whether, you know, it was hard to know whether that was based in fact or just sort of some, you know, legacy of this is difficult or that is difficult here. And so we first did a community survey where we did just knocked on doors and did a really comprehensive look at what the community in general thought about teen pregnancy and education and access to clinic care. And from that, we had a lot of great information. It really paralleled a lot of what we know from state data and national data. But what our leadership groups told us even after that was we need to be able to say what parents think. And even though many of those people who answered the community survey we did were parents, it wasn't it wasn't generalizable. It wasn't, you know, we couldn't say all of the parents thought this, or it wasn't enough parents in that survey to generalize what they were saying. So it became apparent that it was important to go deeper. And the point here is that local data, even if it ends up paralleling what state data says, or surveys say, or national surveys say, it's a very powerful tool to have local data. And so we thought, okay, well, we need to take it a step further and ask parents what they think about teen pregnancy, about access to education and clinic services, mm-hmm. and what they want for their own kids, so we can make it really personal for the parents of Gaston County. Let's see. And we wanted to make sure that it wasn't just this group that's working on teen pregnancy. You know, we weren't going to ask the questions. We really wanted it to be from an independent. We wanted to engage an independent research firm so that there would be less question for the results, or that we could really support the findings with the methodology we used and the independence of the research. So that was important too. And so after this phone survey we did of 401 parents, we found that parents were very supportive. On the slide that's up, this is just one snapshot of questions that they answered. And these questions are more in general, so just in general, teaching teens about sexual health leads them to be healthy adults. Do you agree? You know, and to what extent do you agree? There's a lot of agreement on all of the items listed here. We also later asked about what they wanted for their own kids and what they wanted that education specifically to look like. The numbers were, in terms of agreeing or strongly agreeing, nothing was under 70%. I think a condom demonstration maybe came in at 70% strongly or somewhat agree. So there was overwhelming support for
do they have intercession or anything?
Sorry, did somebody have a question? Oh, sorry, I thought somebody had a question. So there was overwhelming support, and there was one question that we asked that's been so important for our leadership teams, and it's really given them a tool to just, you know, kind of pull out of their pocket really quickly. And that was, we asked parents to say which statement, and I'll read the statements. Which statement they identified with the most in terms of what they wanted for their own child. And the first statement was, although they were read in different orders, but in a different order each time. But the first statement is, I want my teen to abstain from sex, so I don't think he or she needs information on birth control. The next one was, I want my teen to abstain from sex, but I also think he or she needs information on birth control. And the last one was, I can accept my teen being sexually active, and I think he or she needs information on birth control. And when we present this in the community, lots of times I'll just say, "What do you think? What do you think the response is?" And overwhelmingly, people will think the first response would get the most answers, or the most parents would choose that statement more than the others. But in reality, the first statement, which was "I want my child to abstain from sex, doesn't need any other information," that was 10%. Of the responding parents. The middle question, I want my teen to abstain from sex, but I also think he or she needs information on birth control, got 80% of parents responding to that one, and the last one got 10%. Now, if you talk to some leaders in the community, they would say the first one was about 90%. No one would have said the last one, and maybe 5 or 10% for that second one. You know, I think if you're in the field, you know that aligns a lot more with what we know that parents want for their kids. But it's been a tremendous tool for and even people on leadership teams, maybe they're not so surprised, but they can say it. They can say it with confidence, and they can and they can say, these are our parents. And what we've seen is when we've shared this information, that's just a very powerful tool to say, these are our parents, and this is what they believe. And we can go to the last slide. So in terms of what I think the value, this particular tool, just this one thing that we've done, has added to the project, it's just that it really has given that a precise tool. And I've seen it at work. I've seen I like to call them episodes of leadership, but when people on our leadership teams, you know, at no prompting from me, and this to me is when you can really see improvement on stakeholder education and involvement and engagement, is when you see them jump up first in defense of teen pregnancy prevention efforts and strategies. When they're the first ones, when they don't look at me first to say, well, can you give some rationale for this? They have the information they need to stand up and either just defend or advance, or whatever the case may be, the project aims and strategies. So that's, you know, it's one simple thing, but it's really it's played a big part in helping our stakeholders feel empowered to lead. And I think that's probably time.
Thanks so much, Sally. This is all really great, and it's great to hear sort of that very specific example of how you all figured out what data you needed and how exactly you went about getting it and using it. And I think at this point we can take some questions. I know that we can take questions within the webinar. There's a place for you to ask questions in that way, to chat them into us. But is there also a way for us to unmute the lines and ask questions?
Yes, what I do is I ask them to please press *1 on the touch tone phone. That will unmute their line so that we may have them ask a question. You'll be prompted to say your name so that I may introduce who it is that's asking the question. Once again, to ask a question over the phone, please press *1. One moment, please.
Thank you.
We have a question from Amber. Go ahead, Amber.
Hi. I have actually four questions, two for Jennifer, I believe, who was the first presenter, and two for Nicole. My first question for Jennifer was, what would you consider to be the right way to share a personal story or testimonial?
Sure. That's a good question. And to be honest, it's not sort of an area of expertise of mine personally, but I think, you know, from the things that I've read about how to sort of solicit and share those personal stories from people, I think the sensitivity is that you're sort of not, particularly where young people are concerned or where sensitive health information is concerned, that you're not sort of exploiting the feelings or the experiences that a young person has in order to advance the goals of your program. And I think one organization that does it really well that you might look to for some guidance on that is actually Families USA. They had a storytelling project that was associated with health reform and how they got people to talk about, you know, situations in which they weren't able to access health care and how they sort of overcame those situations. It's sort of associated with the law passing over the last few years. So I know Families USA is a good source of that.
Great. I also wanted to ask you, Jennifer, what would you categorize as a meaningful opportunity? I think that was on one of your first few slides.
Yeah, thanks for that question. I think in terms of what we're talking about today, it sort of depends on your organization, what you set out to do. I think, and it depends on the community members who are becoming involved. I think what I basically would caution you to be mindful of is to are situations in which you may engage the community in a way in such a way that their feedback isn't necessarily being appreciated or incorporated. So again, sort of going back to that point about if you ask people what they think about a particular issue or how you should move forward on a particular issue, sort of having a process in place for how you plan to use that information is really important, and that they don't sort of feel like their advice is being ignored. I also think that one thing you can run up against is, you know, having a champion who really, you know, wants to do something and sort of not making space for those opportunities to actually exist. So I think it just comes down to really thinking about who it is you're talking about and what the best, most mutually beneficial way for them to contribute might be that sort of, again, fits within what you can do within this particular project.
Great, thank you. And for Nicole, could you elaborate a little bit more about your efforts for more increased parental involvement?
Sure. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I'm not sure, but boy, am I low tech. I don't know if I'm supposed to hit star one or what's happening. Okay. Yes, I'll talk to you. I'd love to talk to you about that. A few strategies that we use. The strategy we've used the longest in general, before we even had what we articulated to be an initiative, we had a Healthy Girls Initiative. The Healthy Girls Initiative is the way that we invest in evidence-based programming for pregnancy prevention within school and community-based organizations. Over the last 3 years, we've really ramped up our expectations of those agencies. So first of all, they all have to use an evidence-based program. They almost universally use Making Proud Choices. But they also have to demonstrate that they have a vibrant and comprehensive parental strategy. Now, those strategies may vary depending on whether it's a school or a community-based organization, but all of the programs at a bare minimum have to have weekly communication with the parents by sharing what they're going to be covering that week in the curriculum. They also have to have at least a monthly in-person touch point. Most of them end up doing sort of a parent class in a community-based setting. And additionally, we have worked with a couple of agencies who do classes just for parents. What we've done so far in terms of that is we've done some internet safety training and some recognizing the signs and symptoms of sexual assault or dating violence, and we've held those throughout the community in a number of different settings.
Great. And one last question. When you were talking about the need for corporate funds and framing the conversation of teen pregnancy prevention for businesses, what would you suggest as framing that conversation? Like, how would you approach how this impacts business?
Well, I can tell you what we did, and I think every community is different, but from our perspective, what was clear was that in Milwaukee, or in Wisconsin in general, the majority of births to teens are paid for by taxpayer dollars. That's just the way that it is. There's no judgment attached to that. It's just the finances of it. So when we went to potential corporate partners, we really laid out the financial case. We talked about tax burdens. We talked about the implications of what happens when young people aren't given every opportunity to succeed and graduate high school. And that doesn't exist in a vacuum. So these young people that we all hear about or that we know about in the abstract, you know, that becomes a cohort, becomes a community of young people who haven't graduated from high school. And the business leaders, if they're going to keep their eye on growing their company and having a successful place of business, where is that next generation of workforce going to come from? We know that the boomers are aging out of the workforce. We know that for the first time in generations, young people have less of a chance of graduating from high school than their parents in our community. So the business leaders get very concerned about that. The other strategy we touch on is that if you're a member of the business community, maybe in a broader sense, so say you run the Chamber of Commerce, if your job is to sell Milwaukee to potential corporations to come relocate and help us with job growth, they're going to look at these social metrics, and they're going to look at high school graduation rate and poverty rate and teen pregnancy rate, and you've got to be concerned about that and do your part if you're going to create a community that is that other people want to move to and relocate to.
Okay, thank you very much.
Sure.
Our next question then comes from Jenny Baker. Go ahead.
Hi. I've often been encouraged to, I think this question would be for Jennifer, but I have often been encouraged to engage stakeholders that could drive a stake in your project as opposed to hold stake in your project. And I would like to discuss whether or not that would be beneficial to kind of talk to those folks about collaborating and determine if there is something that can be done to keep them from killing your project. Have you ever attempted to do this?
Hi, Jenny. Can you just say a little bit more about that question?
Yeah, so within stakeholders, people often engage folks that would already encourage the project, that already have buy-in. Teen pregnancy, birth control, abortion, all of those things can be quite controversial with a lot of folks. And we have often had entities that would want to destroy the project or remove the project from our state. So we've wondered if engaging those folks in the beginning in order to find out what it is about the project that would keep them from killing the project or trying to keep it from happening within the state.
I mean, this is Katie, one of Jennifer's colleagues. I can talk about some of the work that we do just here with general education of policymakers that I think is sort of getting to this. You know, there's a lot of new freshman congressmen that might not know about teen pregnancy in general or even just sort of funding sources for it. And I know our policy team has been actively engaging that group to just inform them about what's happening, the importance of it, why teen pregnancy is important, or teen pregnancy prevention is important, and why evidence-based programs such as the ones, you know, funded through the Office of Adolescent Health are so critical. And I think that they've found that they're actually getting a lot of questions from those congressional offices because they just – no one's talking to them, and so they are sort of operating on rumors almost. And so by engaging them up front and saying, let me just tell you about that, about this project overall, I think has been actually more helpful than we would have originally anticipated. We sort of went into these discussions saying, well, there must be a reason, they must be against this funding. And we're actually not finding that, we're just finding a really low level of education and assumptions on either end, if that makes sense.
Yeah, as a general matter, people, I think, assume the worst about the things that they don't understand. For example, a lot of these offices have been surprised to find out that many of you are doing abstinence programs. So programs that talk a lot about abstinence are very focused on abstinence. That's news to them when we go into their offices. And I think, you know, just even providing little tidbits like that about the thing that hits the nerve for them can go a long way. So, I mean, one step to take in the community, if you do decide to engage folks who are on that end of the spectrum, is just to ask them what it is that they are so opposed to so that you're not sort of attacking the problem sort of in a vacuum, and that you really understand actually what the problem is and that you're addressing it in a way that is actually helpful.
Nicole, do you want to say anything about this?
I was gonna just jump in and say I can't agree enough with the people that spoke previously. I wanted to say that I think a lot of the debate is muddied by sound bites and extreme opinions. I know in our case, we've spent a lot of time educating people what comprehensive sex education means, for example, because for some reason, members of the media, political members, have sort of divided us into this, you're either for abstinence or you're for sex camps, which is just silly. I mean, I think all of us would agree, whatever our perspective is and however we think we get to this outcome, most of us wish that young people would abstain from sex until they were older and physically and emotionally capable of handling it. That being said, I can't stress enough the importance of providing potential naysayers or people who have even put up roadblocks with fact-based, calmly expressed information, and I think that goes a long way. I mean, there are some people who are never going to come around. That's the reality of it. But I think most people fall into this middle ground where they just they're afraid or they're confused because they don't have enough information. And when you help them through it and you show them what our comprehensive sex curriculum really looks like and how much emphasis is placed on abstinence, they feel a lot better about it.
Jennifer, can I add to that? This is Sally.
Of course.
I 100% agree with what was just said, but I'd like to add a finer point, or at least an additional point, and that is that we've had to struggle with where do we make the call, where how much is too much time to spend, or how much energy do you spend on the very, very polarized, you know, it's probably 0.01% or less. I think I agree with Nicole, 99.9% are going to be in that area that, you know, that is responsive to reason and explanation and outreach and conversation. I think that's the majority, but I do think you and we have run into people where it just we've had to make a call. Gosh, how much energy do we respond with in terms of you know, efforts to try to deconstruct the project aims or efforts?
Absolutely.
So I think that you know, that's a reality.
Absolutely, agreed.
Jennifer, this is Melissa with JBS. Two things. I think we should, in light of time, take one more question. And I know Tish from OAH had to jump off the call, so I just want to remind folks to be very careful to not get into lobbying with federal dollars. So educating and stuff, just make sure you're having that conversation internally, because I know she'd want me to say something. So I'm just going to say that, and let's take one more question just based on time.
At this time, we have no further questions on that.
Well, there you go. Okay.
Perfect timing.
Awesome. Well, this is Melissa from JBS International, and I just really want to thank our presenters for a really informative and dynamic call. I know I learned an incredible amount, and I think there's a lot of good ideas and energy to move forward as you think about engaging folks in a really passionate topic that, like you guys said, folks have strong opinions about. So this is great, and I hope folks get a lot out of it. In a week's time, actually next week, we'll be launching the virtual learning community, the TPP Grantee Exchange. So I hope that the conversations continue on the exchange around this topic, as Jennifer and Katie will both be up on the exchange to kind of chat with folks about it. So with that, I thank Sally, Nicole, and of course Jennifer and Katie at the National Campaign, and hope that folks have a great rest of the day.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.